Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After each episode, you can connect with others in the sarcoma community on our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to delve deeper into the episode's topics. You can find information on this specific subtype or your subtype, as well as all our podcast episodes on SFA's website, www.curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. Follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. Thanks for listening. In this episode, we speak with the Brenneman family, who lost their father and husband, David, 12 years ago. We discuss the care partner experience of navigating a spouse's sarcoma diagnosis while also raising young children, and what it has been like for the family to find connection to David after his passing. The Brenneman family shares about how this experience has fit into their lives and evolved over the years, and talk about their unique experience walking the Camino de Santiago to raise awareness and funds in support of the sarcoma community. Thank you to the Brenneman family for sharing their story and allowing us to be a small part of honoring David's legacy. Let's dive in. Welcome to Sarcoma Stories. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am one of your hosts, Tasha Nathan. I am the Program Manager of Engagement and Advocacy, and I am also a sarcoma survivor.
And hi, I'm Brandy Felser, and I am the CEO at SFA.
I'm AJ Brenneman, and I'm 17 years old.
I'm Will Brenneman, and I'm 19 years old.
And I'm Maggie Brenneman, and I'm 14 years old.
And I'm their mom, Mina. I'm 50.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We are so thrilled to have you on the podcast and talk a bit about your journey as a family who has experienced sarcoma. For our listeners, your father and your husband, David, passed from sarcoma, from alveolar rhabdomyosarcoma. And we would like to start off by hearing a bit about his journey from the point of his diagnosis and his time in treatment before we get into where we are now. So would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
And let me say this, we're particularly interested in the misdiagnosis and how that impacted, if it did impact his treatment from one subtype to another.
So yeah, I think I can speak to these questions since the kids were very young at the time. Maggie was 2. AJ was 5 and Will was 7 when David was very suddenly diagnosed in May of 2012. The way that it happened, it just happened right here in our kitchen. One morning he woke up and found a very large lump under his left collarbone that seemingly had just popped out overnight. So that led us to the emergency room, to immediate scans, and to meeting some a sarcoma specialist. We went through all the diagnostic points. And at that point, they thought it was stage 3 leiomyosarcoma. And then very quickly, within a few weeks, they kind of upgraded it to stage 4. And David went through initially a very aggressive course of chemotherapy to try to shrink that primary tumor before he went in for a surgery and then radiation. At first, it seemed like we were just kind of gaining on the whole progression of the cancer, and things were looking up. The primary tumor was resected and taken out. The margins weren't great because it was very close to the chest wall and it was in a very bad spot. And then he had to have another surgery to take out some small little tumors in his right lung. And then by the end of the summer in 2012, the scans looked good and everything. So we had a period of maybe a couple of months where things were looking up. And when we went back after Hurricane Sandy, actually, and did more scans, it turned out that the cancer was back and very aggressively so. So we threw practically the kitchen sink of this thing for the next several months, and nothing seemed to really be stopping just the spread of the cancer to other parts of David's body. And then I'm not exactly sure. Our doctor at the time was very sort of surprised at how things were progressing. So we ran some, and it didn't look like this was behaving like a typical leiomyosarcoma. So our doctor ordered some extra pathology at one point after one of David's surgeries, because he had a couple of others. And that's when it turned out, you know, that it was actually alveolar rhabdomyosarcoma. But that kind of the correction of the diagnosis happened only 3 months, basically, before David passed away. And at that point, we made the decision to switch. We felt that there was another doctor who could help us with this kind of new diagnosis and new course of treatment. So it went about as smoothly as we possibly could have expected, but it was still very jarring, switching doctors and switching just the whole protocol and nurses and all of that. But, you know, we obviously were ready to do anything. That was the final 3 months. Again, it was, you know, to the very last moment. Now we were open to trying everything. And, you know, and even in the last few days of David's life, he was talking to his doctor about trying on different protocols, clinical trials, and so on. So, yeah, he went out with gun blazing, not giving up for a second. And that was it. But it was very, very odd and very kind of unexpected to get this misdiagnosis and the course correction so soon before he died.
At any point when you got the new diagnosis, did they have a conversation about the treatment plan and the treatment that you had been doing? Because in sarcoma, treatment is very directed towards your particular subtype.
Exactly.
So was there a conversation with the new medical team about the previous treatment as opposed to where you were going in the future?
It was. Those were difficult conversations. I'm not going to lie that we felt like, I don't know, that things could have gone differently had this been diagnosed earlier. But you always have that kind of nagging thought at the back of your mind, the what it. So, I mean, there was never a doubt in our minds that our doctors were doing their absolute best. So from that point of view, we didn't have any regret. But I guess we never fully understood how that could have been missed in all the pathology analyses of, you know, of the samples that they took from David's tumor. It was difficult. And that's something that after David died, I personally, just knowing the full progression and the story, I had a very difficult time kind of coming to terms with.
I think that is something that a lot of people find themselves in, that situation of looking back on their diagnosis, whether it's a misdiagnosis or not, of how was I supposed to know to ask certain questions? You have to learn everything about it very quickly. And so it's hard not to look back on it and say, what if, in a rare disease?
Absolutely.
And I know that this happened many years ago, but how old was David when he was diagnosed?
He was 36, and he was, honestly, he was so healthy and everything that he didn't even have a primary care provider. And when we would go to these various oncologists and surgeons and, you know, all the various cancer specialists, they always took the patient history first as their part of their intake protocol. And they would ask him, well, what brings you here? And he would say, well, other than the stage 4 cancer, nothing's wrong with me. I'm perfectly healthy. It was completely out of the blue.
So one of the things that you mentioned, Mina, is the support from friends and family. And we're asking for that support. And as we talk to different people affected by sarcoma and hear their stories, that is one thing that actually comes up a lot. If you had young children at the time and being a care partner and watching someone you love go through something so serious and life-changing, what was that like to ask for help? And what advice would you have for others who are also maybe not reaching out for help in ways that they could?
Oh, it was brutally hard for us to come to the point where we were on the same page, in agreement, and ready to ask for help, because neither David nor I were the kind of people who did that. We were extremely self-sufficient and had always dealt with everything by ourselves. Things developed very quickly from that first morning in our kitchen when David spotted the lump. And I think it took us about a month to realize that we were in something well over our head. And so I raised the point with David, and it was a very difficult conversation between the two of us about how many people we were going to tell, whether he was going to tell people at work. We were obviously going to bring in our extended family into this and some of our closest friends, but then it wasn't clear to us, do we communicate this to our local sort of town community, to the school where the kids were going, and all of that, all these layers and circles of various overlapping communities. And I did something which was very unlike me and out of character, but I was the one pushing for the help because I felt that I couldn't possibly just handle taking care of the kids while also just being fully present with David at the hospital. We spoke to our closest family and friends, and David mentioned it to his boss at work. And that was really all we had to do, because very organically and very quickly, these people mobilized and kind of spread the word. And within literally a week, we had meal trains going. People were coming out of the woodwork offering play dates and just watching the kids, and we had family coming over and all of these people. David's colleagues at work were absolutely phenomenal. They really became a second family to him and to us. And this happened throughout the 15 months that he was in treatment, and perhaps even more so after he died, because I was in a complete fog. And all of these people really helped, especially throughout the first year, get the kids and me through those first months without David. And I met so many people in the process, people here in town that I didn't even know. They would come up to me and introduce themselves and say, we had your kids over for a play date the other day. You were at the hospital. You don't even know. We really kind of just expanded our circle of really good friends who came to us in our real hour of need. And it's something that we will never forget. And this is honestly part of the reason why we're still living in the town that we're in, because, you know, that community that kind of grew around us.
You mentioned something that I want to draw attention to, that this community surrounded you through David's diagnosis, but also after he died. And I think there's this misconception with a cancer diagnosis that there's an end point, whether you survive or whether you pass, that it's over at that point. But that statement to me is kind of the example that there really is not an end, and the support has to continue beyond, whether it's in survivorship or grief. And to hear that your community still shows up with you in that time of grief is so important. And I think when people ask, how can I help, how would you tell someone to phrase that question? Because I think when you're in the grief or you're in the hard moment, it's hard sometimes to even think of the help you need.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think I was in no position to articulate anything that we needed, because I couldn't even think through some of the things. So I think what people can do is, I don't know, just show up, basically. A lot of these people just showed up. They spoke with each other, and they figured out from like the essentials. Like I couldn't, you know, wrap my mind around meal planning and logistics and rides for the kids and all of these. But those are the things that honestly just kept our life going, because, you know, as one of my friends said, you know, your husband may be dying, but we still need toilet paper at the house. Somebody is not picking up the toilet paper and making sure that there's milk in the fridge. And so these are like such simple yet such vital things. And you don't, as somebody who wants to help, there's no real need for that to be spelled out. If you want to help, you can actually ask the other helpers what's needed. I think that would be your point of contact. The person who is in the middle of this is not going to be able to give you instructions or articulate needs.
Right. I like that. Ask the other helpers. Look to the helpers, they say, and you'll probably get a better idea than asking.
Yes, they knew everything about like what my family needed, to the point like where I didn't know what we needed. David died literally 2 days before the start of school.
If you think that I had school supplies or backpacks or any of these things, no. But I came back from the hospital and there was literally a pile of packages by the front door because people made lists and ordered from Amazon. And we literally just, you know, I spent an afternoon just opening packages and just giving the kids all of their school supplies and clothing. And that to me was absolutely astounding. Because I hadn't even thought that, oh my gosh, my kids need to go to school in 2 days.
Yeah. And I think it's a simple, I don't even want to say simple, because buying someone school supplies and toilet paper when they're in that position, it sounds simple, but it is, look how much of an impact it's made. Years later, you're still talking about it. And so when people think about helping, it doesn't have to be bigger than that to make an impact and show up. Like you said, just show up.
Just show up and you figure out immediately what's needed.
Yeah.
Something that Atasha said previously is with a cancer diagnosis, there's not an end to it. And it continues. And with the kids being so young, I want to talk to them a little bit about all these years later, how it still impacts their life. And I know in many different ways, you're all dealing with it in different ways and doing different things. But Will, you mentioned being the oldest, you were 7 when your father was diagnosed, and being the oldest sibling, I can imagine responsibility was different for you growing up, but also having to maneuver through life, having more of an experience with your dad's journey. How has that impacted you as you've grown up?
Yeah. I don't know. It was always just kind of like, it never really occurred to me as it was happening, because when something that tragic happens in your life, it just, it's kind of like do or die. Like you just do what you have to do. And I think that, and just knowing my dad's battle and knowing the years he went through of all these horrible radiation treatments and surgeries, so just the person I am today, to me, it's never an option to give up. It's not, it's always just do first and think later, and how I've built myself, and that's how you know, I've become the person I am today.
And AJ, you have focused a lot on advocacy and doing outreach and fundraising, and I know this year you did something very special for your dad.
Yeah, so first, like, I never really could wrap my head around the fact that my dad was gone. I mean, like, when you're going through it originally, especially when you're so young, I was 5 at the time of the diagnosis and 6 at the time of his death. I don't really remember anything from then, but I remember, like, as I got older, like, things kind of hinted in that, like, we were different. I didn't have the same life as my friends. And I think it was really the summer going into my junior year where, like, I had a sudden realization that, like, wow, my dad isn't with us anymore. And it kind of, like, changed my whole way of thinking and just, like, what my values were. That was probably my rock bottom when things didn't make sense. I didn't really know who I was anymore. And, like, I don't know, really after talking with my mom and, like, reflecting on it, I decided that I don't want to stay rock bottom. I want to swim back up and see, like, what can I do so that other people, and specifically kids, don't have to feel like this. And after so much planning, and we were able to think to walk 200 miles from Portugal to Spain to really, like, share my story and get word out there. And in doing this, I started a blog to share some of the stories of when I was young and what I do remember, but also how people have helped me, how I've grown up, my relationships with other people. And in doing this, I reached a lot of people. My blog got over 12,000 total views. So it's very nice to see that people were watching and listening throughout the entire journey. And it also was a chance for me to bond my siblings and my mom a little more. And I feel like something we didn't do too often throughout my childhood was talk to each other. We were all in the same boat, but it felt like we weren't connected at all. But during the walk, we had like very nice heart-to-heart moments. And it's this realization that we weren't alone. We all had each other. That was definitely a turning point in my life. I feel like I can finally come to terms with my dad's death and realize that even though I thought I'd been alone, that I have a whole army that's raised me and taught me so much.
I definitely want to talk more about your walk and the journey you all took together on that. But something that you and Will have just brought up is the grief, I think, of losing your father at a young age. And AJ, you and I have talked about this in preparation for the podcast, but how that grief evolves with you as you're growing up. And you mentioned hitting rock bottom. And I think there are so many others in your position who know what that feeling is like. And so I guess my question is to you, aside from planning the walk and going through that process, you and Will and Maggie, what were the resources that helped you navigate grief growing up? And I know grief doesn't end, right? It continues. But up to this point in your life, where have you found the ways to process that and the resources to help you with that?
Yeah. So first, I found comfort in my closest friends. I found that, you know, opening up to them and hearing what they have to say was extremely helpful for me. And they said, like, I seem a little more down. What's up? And it's just those little, like, conversations and acknowledgements that, like, you know, people are here for me. That definitely helped me realize that I don't have to go through this alone. But also the treehouse, when we were younger, that was our support group. That definitely, even though we were young when we did it, it was a way for me to open up and talk about my feelings, even if they weren't fully, I guess, when they developed when I was back then, because I couldn't really understand what was happening. But it's like these like little communities, your friends, your support groups, but also your family. I know we said we didn't talk too much, but still being in the presence of one another, that was very comforting. I remember, especially during that summer, when I hit rock bottom, me, my mom, and Maggie, we'd watch Gilmore Girls for a while, and just being surrounded by people that you love and people that have also like gone through with you what you had is a way to kind of, you know, feel a little better.
Have you at any time, have any of you felt as if you're worried about talking it about to others? Like maybe you didn't want to bring it up to your friends or other people because they might look at you differently or they couldn't understand or they might treat you differently. Did you ever have any of you ever have any worries about that?
Yeah, I think it's been kind of difficult because like opening up to people who like don't know what you're going through, because it's easier to open up to family who like experience it with you, but opening up to friends who like have a whole different reality, like a whole like perspective on like their parents and like growing up like that, like don't know what it's like. So eventually I have opened up, but like it's taken me like a while to like find people that I can trust, that I can tell. And like, but it has been difficult because they live like in a whole new perspective and they don't really know what's happening in my life.
Yeah. And just to add on, like we're in a town where a lot of people have their mom and their dad present. So when people would learn that our dad died, in a way we felt kind of ostracized. Sometimes people would just give us like a sorry look. And it's not like we're hurt. It's not like, I mean, we obviously are hurt, but it's not like we're like these puppies that need to be sheltered from the world. It's like we don't want to be treated differently. We just want to be treated like we were having a normal conversation. Like the number of parents we have does not change anything.
Yes, I think, go ahead, Mina.
Yeah, so this is, I agree with everything Maggie and AJ said, and it's kind of an interesting counterpoint or perhaps a contradiction to what I said about the community that embraced us initially. But that's also just, I think, and this is something that I've been grappling with because it's definitely true that we do feel different. There is only me at soccer games, at various events, or with almost everybody else, there's two parents. And I think this is just partly human nature. I think people tend to mobilize greatly in times of crisis and distress, but eventually they do go back to their own normal lives. And they do, there's like this drop off and this feeling that, well, okay, it's been a year or it's been 2 years, and why aren't you back to normal? Haven't you bounced back? Can you just kind of rejoin everything in just your normal, typical way? And the reality is that that's not going to be happening with us ever, right? We will not bounce back to some previous state. We've been permanently altered by what happened. And, you know, and so this is the reality, you know, after this initial, you know, incredible boost and everything, and just that carried us through the 2 or perhaps 2.5, 3 years initially. After that, it's just been, it's been different. And the more the kids grow up, they've become very aware and very sensitive to this. And I think, you know, as AJ pointed out, the reason that he hit rock bottom last year, it was just really the older and more sophisticated that they become, the more they realize all of these nuances and, you know, kind of the social environment and all that. So yeah, it's been an interesting journey from that point of view.
When I lost my mom, I had a very close friend, and so I'm going to the point where you said it just doesn't go back. None of you will ever be the same people again. It profoundly changes you. And I say that a lot about, I lost my mom, and then years later, I lost my dad. Both had cancer. And I had a very close friend say to me when I was really struggling, I wish you'd just go back to being normal again. And I thought to myself, I don't know who that person is anymore. I don't know who that person is. I have been so profoundly changed by this journey that I can't just go back to being that person. But it was like, I wish you would just get over it. And I was shocked, honestly, by that conversation. I think about it all the time, though. I think about it all the time, that response of just going back to normal. And so it goes to, I think, Maggie, your point where you said people just don't understand. They don't understand. They don't understand the journey. And I say to myself all the time, I didn't understand it until I went through it. And I don't think you can, because how hard it is to go through. And I don't think you can understand it unless it's something that you've been the unfortunate person who's had to go through it. So it isn't something that just, you don't just bounce back, as you said, you don't just bounce back.
And it's interesting too, you know, what you said about that people mobilize in a crisis, and it's true. And the support you receive is so important. It's what helps you survive these tragic events in life. But there is a point where people return, quote unquote, to normal, and you're stuck in figuring out your new normal. And I know even for me, going through the diagnosis myself, I've always said to myself, I'm so glad everyone else went back to normal, because it means they haven't experienced this tragedy that I've experienced. But I wish they could for a day understand my perspective of how my life isn't the same anymore. And it's hard to relate sometimes and have people understand this is different for me now. And if you lose someone as well, this is, my life is different now. And that's just a fact.
Yeah. Even with some of your closest people, I've experienced this with family members, even with closest friends. It's, mm-hmm. There's like this invisible barrier that like I haven't been able to quite get across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Something I constantly think about is like what my life would be like if my dad was still around. And sometimes I just look at my friends and try and think that like that could be me. And like I see all the subtle differences of like what their normal is versus what my normal is. Like, for example, my friends got their license so they could just drive wherever and have fun. Whereas I got my license pretty much the day I could, to help my mom drive, to drive my sister, to drive my grandparents, and just be there for my family. Whereas my friends didn't necessarily have that responsibility. And it's like seeing these different types of normals. Yes, I do really value the responsibility, all the lessons I've learned. But sometimes I do wish that I could have their version of normal.
The carefree version of normal. Yeah.
Yeah. Your reality changes quite a bit when when you take on the responsibilities that you've had to take on and the experiences that you've had. And I think that is a really good point you make, AJ. I think all three of you mentioned this in our preparation, that you have had to grow up a bit more quickly than your peers and mature in different ways. And there's a duality of that, of valuing the responsibility you have, but also grieving this carefree childhood. And so I'm curious what your experience has been with that. For example, AJ, you say you got your license for the purpose of helping out at home. Will, I know you were kind of, the oldest and the leader. So I'm curious of what that experience has been for you, helping your mom as a single mom parent, the three of you growing up in the absence of your father.
I mean, just simple things you wouldn't think about, like making dinner or waking them up for school in the morning or putting them to sleep on school nights. Just, I don't know, stuff that seems like pretty mundane until you actually have to do it. I also know my mom, she definitely encourages my independence. So I do things like book my own doctor's appointments, set up everything. So just being able to do that and being able to function on my own is a function, I think, of knowing what it's like to have that potentially taken away from you and knowing that you need to always be prepared and always know how to survive on your own.
Yeah, I think Will brought up some really good points about, we have to do stuff that other people won't have to think about. But something that I felt like I couldn't do was just stop. I never thought for a second to just sit down and just think about it. I always just told myself to keep going, keep doing my best, and to keep working at the best level. Because I felt like that after Dad died, I couldn't fail. I had to just keep working and keep succeeding. And while, yes, it did help me, I also feel like that lack of rest, that lack of time to just grieve and think to myself is probably why I hit rock bottom so late after my dad's death. And I really wish that I could just taken the time to sit down and talk and realize that I understand what my life isn't normal, but it doesn't mean that I have to be oblivious to it.
And sometimes taking the time to sit down also helps you to process, right? And to understand what those feelings are and to understand those. And I think, Maggie, what I got from you from the preparation is that's something that you, even though you were 2 years old when your father was diagnosed, it's something that you are processing now. And where do you find support for the journey that you're going through?
Yeah, so I was pretty young when he was diagnosed. So even now, you never fully are over it. So every day I used to think that it happened so long ago that I should be fine now. It happened so long ago that I shouldn't be affected by it now. But the reality, every year is just a new year. You experience new things without them. And you unlock new things I used to do without a father. And recently I've started, like AJ mentioned earlier, the Treehouse, which was our old support group. And just so every time they meet, I go over there and I welcome the families and I kind of talk to them and relate to them, which is actually very comforting because a lot of them, they don't have a father, they don't have a mother, they lost a thing or something, which I've never met many people who have experienced that. So just kind of the spoken thing where we all relate together is very comforting.
Yeah, it sounds like you've really found community. And I think this is something all four of you have mentioned is how important being surrounded by community is and finding that as a resource. And something that I'm thinking of as each of you talk about the evolution of your grief and your experience throughout the ages is something AJ said, that you don't have to be a certain age to make a difference. And I'm thinking of that in terms of grief is your grief doesn't finalize at a certain age either. And you don't have to grieve at a certain time and a certain age. And so both of those things are true. AJ, I'm curious if we could explore a little what you mean by you don't have to be a certain age to make a difference. And I think I know where you're going with this. It might be the walk, but I want to hear from your perspective what that means.
Yeah. Oh,
I mean, I know what it's like to be at your worst, and especially after something that's traumatic, but it's probably the worst feeling one could experience. So I just wanted to know, what can I do? I haven't seen too many kids my age do anything. I was like, well, why is that? Is there some restriction? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized, no, I just don't think some people have grieved fully or have put themselves out there. And I think that right after I hit rock bottom, I was able to overcome that hurdle. I realized that I'm willing to put myself at the world stage to help others. And I think that once I started writing my blog, I realized that I put myself in my most vulnerable state on the internet, where anyone could search up who I am. And it didn't matter how young I was. I actually think it kind of helped my case in reaching a different audience and reaching more people. See that, oh, this kid, he struggled, but he's trying to do something about it. And I think that that helped with donations. As that I kept writing, as the wall came closer, people were really rooting for me. That's when the donations piled in. I realized that, you know, you didn't have to be this young to do something. You could have waited till you're older, but there's nothing stopping you when you're 16. I was 16 when I started the blog, and just like, I don't know, like nothing stopped me. My age wasn't a factor. Even Will and Maggie, they wrote on the blog. And again, they're young. Will's 19. Maggie's...
I was 13.
Maggie was 13. That's the youngest person I've seen write something so beautiful. It was just a different perspective, which I think a lot of people couldn't necessarily relate to, but something that they could feel for. And once we started the walk, that's when my age kind of helped me a little bit. Because I was in a very good physical state.
All three of them were. They left me at no least. I said, well, I walked last because I was taking it. So that puts my story and I'm sticking to it. But they just powered through the walk. I was amazed, actually. I was a little hurt, but they were amazing on the walk.
Tell us about this walk for the listeners. Where did you get the idea? And tell us about organizing it, and then we can hear a bit about your experience.
Okay, well, I'll give a little bit of the backstory. So we did what's known as the Portuguese Camino. So there are various routes starting in different countries in Europe, all kind of converging on the city of Santiago de Compostela in Spain. So all of these different routes are collectively known as the Camino de Santiago. And they're one of the most ancient Christian pilgrimages. You know, Santiago was one of the three main centers, Jerusalem, Rome, and then Santiago. And so, the most famous route is the French way, the Camino Francés, which starts in France and goes all the way across Spain, east to west to Santiago. And that's 500 miles. I'd done that back in 2016, actually also as a fundraiser for the SFA. So we had a little bit of experience in our family and a lot of talking about the Camino de Santiago. But what we decided to do because of just various time constraints and also wanting to explore a different route, we started in Porto in Portugal and took the coastal route to Santiago, which is about almost exactly 200 miles. And that's why. And AJ came up with the title, the name for his project, which is, I'm going to let him take over from here. But that's my backstory.
Yeah. We ended up calling it 200 Miles Closer to Dad. And I think that name had a lot of significance throughout the walk. I originally thought that as we were walking, I'd really get closer to him. Once we reached Santiago, I'd like see him again. And I know that was crazy to think, but that was my expectation throughout the walk. And it really wasn't until I was writing my final blog post where I realized that was a bit silly and that I was actually getting closer to my dad every day. I was walking. I mean, you're not really talking too much while you walk and get in this groove and you just put one foot in front of the other and you're alone with your thoughts. And so the more I was thinking about it, the more I was just thinking about my dad, who he was as a person, because I mean, I never really met him. I don't remember his voice. I don't remember too much about him. But I feel like that I was able to develop this idea of him while I was walking, and throughout like all of the blog posts, I always put a picture of me and him, or like a picture of him. So I remember these pictures while I was walking and kind of have a conversation with him. And I realized that at the end of the day, I didn't get 200 miles closer to him, but I got infinitely closer to him.
Will and Maggie, what was the walk like for you both?
It was very difficult, to say the least. I think the hardest part was realizing at the end, because as AJ was kind of talking about earlier, is that like he thought that like the second we reached the end and like the second we reached Santiago is like you're automatically just like closer to dad. I kind of realized that throughout the end, like the hardships throughout the walk, the unspoken connection with like your family and like sharing memories, like it was like the journey that brought us closer to him, not the finish line.
Yeah. Yeah, it was obviously tough walking 15, 20 miles a day, but I do think that, you know, just having that time where you're just walking and you're alone in your head, that definitely did help to build my connection to my dad and help me to, you know, think about things that I really wouldn't have been able to pay attention to had I been just going about my day normally and doing the things I usually do. It just gave me an opportunity for self-reflection. Reading my brother's blog posts and sharing stories with my family definitely helped to give me some material to think over during the walk.
I can't imagine walking 15 to 20 miles a day. Like, congratulations to you. That is a lot of walking.
And to do so much processing, it's therapeutic and a lot of hard work. That is mentally and physically a lot of hard work that you all did.
Yeah. While you were doing the walk, did you also ever think about what you were giving back to the sarcoma community? Because while you were walking to get closer to your dad, you also had raised so much money for sarcoma community and research and sarcoma. Did you ever think about that or even talk about it while you were walking, about we're turning something that's really a negative in our life into something positive so we can give back to others?
So when we originally started the walk, I think one of the biggest goals was to raise money and really help the sarcoma community. But selfishly, like as the walk progressed, I kind of took the walk in a little more for myself. I took it as a chance to finally do the grieving and finally reconnect with my dad. And I definitely did want to help. I mean, of course, that we wanted to help out the sarcoma community. I didn't say it earlier because I guess I thought it was implied, but the sarcoma community has genuinely helped me the most of anything. I mean, like just having people you could relate to. And it's not like you need to explicitly say it either. It's a little more implied. It's a good comforting feeling.
It's interesting because the whole project really, I feel, happened in two parts. First was the blog and the fundraising, which happened over 5 months before the walk. And there, the goal was explicitly to raise as much awareness, kind of widen the circle and raise the funds. And I think it's only natural that once we started walking, it became much more oriented toward like our personal story and kind of the connection with David, because I think we all felt that the bulk of the work was done in terms of that external raising the funds and awareness. And we had to turn inward because the walk was just so intense physically and mentally that we had to kind of just go together and take care of each other. But I think that that's just organically just part of the process. When we finished the walk and came out of it and were able to reflect and see, okay, what did we accomplish? Did we reach what AJ had explicitly set out to do? And both of these aspects of the project, we felt, were equally strong and important, but very different. One was the outward orient, but helping the larger community. And the other was the inward, just helping each other and each of us individually and internally.
There was one day, I think it was on the seventh day of the walk, where I was having a really rough start to the morning. It was very sunny out. And even though I had my hat and sunglasses on, the sun would always find a way in. So that was pretty frustrating. And I was listening to Hamilton, which is unrelated, but I thought that was funny. But once we were 5 miles in, we stopped at a cafe for breakfast. I remember sitting down and just thinking, I don't want to continue walking. I just want to sit here and just stay here. And we had breakfast for an hour and trying just procrastinate the rest of the walk. But once we eventually found the strength to stand up, a gust of wind knocked my water bottle out of its pocket. A lot of people in that situation, I can imagine, would be furious and probably give up right then and there. But I actually laughed because earlier in the year, in February, I visited Cape Cod and the beach where we spread my dad's ashes. And right as I stepped on the beach, a sudden blizzard engulfed me. And it was a bright and beautiful day. But the second my feet touched the sand, it started snowing. So I thought of that. And then when the wind knocked my water bottle out, I saw it was my dad playing a prank on me and telling me to keep going. And it was like this reconnection with him. I was like, yes, of course, I want to help the sarcoma community, but I also want to, you know, feel closer to my dad. And I think the duality of it was very beneficial. And to be honest, like, there was really no harm from doing this. I'm so happy I did. And I know that I'm going to do stuff later on for the sarcoma community, but maybe even walk another Camino.
It's amazing. The signs are there, AJ. They're always there if you look for them. They're always there.
Mina, I want to ask you a little bit about your role as like the care partner and the experience that you went through while watching someone you love go through something devastating, but also trying to maintain, as you mentioned, maintain things at home, but also being present at the doctor's appointments and really playing a role in the decisions being made throughout the journey and keeping track of things while David was going through treatment and managing all of that. What was that experience like from the care partner's perspective?
Ooh, it was intense and it was tough. And I couldn't juggle all the various balls. I feel like, you know, in retrospect, you know, I'm trying to cut myself some slack, but I was very remiss in kind of taking care of the kids because I really fully focused on David and just being there with him. I didn't know what I was doing, clearly. I just kind of learned as I went along. I didn't even know like how to take notes during doctor's appointments. I had to talk to people and just ask for advice, like, how do I keep track of this? This is such a massive amount of information and knowledge that we all of a sudden have to deal with. So there was a lot of that, just the sheer amount. It was like a blizzard of stuff to think through and organize and everything. And I think I'm kind of pretty well organized by nature. I just sort of assumed that role so that David could just focus on himself and kind of manage his feelings and thoughts. So I became kind of the secretary, the driver, the manager of like all of that stuff. But with that, as I said, I wasn't able at the same time to do that for my kids. So it was a choice and it was very, it was rough and very uncomfortable. Just handling all, just even the simple logistics and speaking with the doctors and the various medical professionals, because I felt I fully took on the role of the questions asker and the advocate. So there was that side of it. And then there was my relationship with David and how we sort of conceptualized the whole experience and spoke to each other. And that was difficult too, because David was so young and so healthy and so vigorous otherwise. So this was an incredible adjustment. And I had certain, you know, thoughts and desires and needs in terms of why I needed to talk to him about, whether it be just the course of how everything was developing or mortality and things like that. And oftentimes David did not want to discuss these things. He didn't want to think about himself dying. I wanted him to write letters to the kids just in case he passed. He completely refused to do that, while at the same time trying to be the absolutely best dad that he could be to them. But he just didn't want to allow himself to think about the possibility that he wouldn't be there for them when they were growing up. So things like that, which were, I mean, they're potentially conflicts, but I also, at every step, David's choices and preferences all kind of took precedence. And I had to respect them and just go along with them. But to this day, I have some regrets about what we didn't do and what I wish or he would have been willing to do or I had been able to do better. These are such very individual things. There's no prescribed plan or like to-do list that you should be checking off. But with all of that, I think one of the things that we did perhaps best, and I'm very happy that we did that, is that we, even though the kids were so young, we sort of fully involved them and brought them along on this in terms of explaining to them at their own level that their dad was sick, that it was serious, that he was going through various treatments. So they were fully aware. There was no hiding the reality from them. So they were able to engage with it just in a very kind of age-appropriate way. And I remember as the final weeks and days of David's life, I had a series of conversations with them about what was happening and where things were headed. And then we continued the conversation with them when they came to the hospital and David had just passed. That was horrendously difficult. And those first days when we came home. But throughout it all, we just, I don't know, I just made the decision that I have to be honest with the kids. And I couldn't sugarcoat it, you know. And I remember one of the first days now I was putting them to bed and we're talking about dad being gone and all of this. And either Will or AJ was like, okay, well, we're missing one person in the family. So I think the best idea, why don't we just get another one? Maybe we should just get a baby and then we will be five again. And of course, it was a very tragic comic moment because I was like, but we can get a baby because we don't have dad. They're like, what do you mean we can't get a baby? So all of a sudden, we're having this conversation about where babies come from. You know, which is like 2 days after David had died. And I'm like, this is completely absurd, but okay, we're having this. So, you know, they had like a number of these things where we're talking about the most kind of unexpected things at the most unexpected times. But that has been the story of the past decade.
But isn't that such a real moment? That is just so real.
And I just didn't know whether to laugh, cry. I mean, I was just, I never could have imagined that we would be in the middle of this conversation right then and there.
I would have many of those. And what AJ said, I think one of the most valuable things from the Camino is that, you know, we would just sit down. We would often be so exhausted in the heat that we would be lying in some random driveway, in somebody's driveway in the heat. And we would be having this completely existential conversation about something, you know, and it was kind of, you know, the same, very incongruous, but very real, you know, topics and people would think of things, you know, so that I think that's where the real, for me, at least, the real gold is, in retrospect, is those are the things that stick with me. And I hope with some of them, yeah, we were sitting down by goats in various random dry places, having conversations about the meaning of life.
Those are things you never forget.
No.
Never forget that. From all of your different perspectives, and we'll start with you, Mina, is what resources or what advice would you leave with someone else who may be going through the same journey that you've experienced?
Let's see. I think it's really important to connect essentially with other people who are going through the same experience, through the same journey. When David had just been recently diagnosed and was starting to go through treatment, I looked around because I wanted to somehow connect him and us with another young family, with young kids who was in a similar boat. But I found an organization called Immerman's Angel, and they put us in touch with another young family where the dad was diagnosed. He had osteosarcoma. And so we kind of befriended this family. We actually never met them in person because they live in the Midwest, but we did sort of establish a regular cadence of conversations. So
David would talk to Ryan, and I would talk to Ryan's wife. And the kids were too little. Their kids were too little, and our kids were too little. So we didn't connect the kids. But David and Ryan and Harmony and I sort of had our kind of conversations. And then at one point, I spoke with Ryan. David spoke with Harmony. So we had that other couple, very similar ages and everything, and very, in many ways, many, many similar experiences. So that was very valuable because nobody else, I felt like not family, not friends, not colleagues, nobody else could really understand the day-to-day struggles and sort of validate them and normalize them for us, except for that couple. And if there's anything, I wish, and maybe this was over a decade ago, but I think that is just tremendously, tremendously comforting and helpful.
Yeah. Immermans is a great program.
And they were able to match us with the specific family, which I was very impressed with. And again, David was at first a little unwilling because he was just such a private person. But so I was the one to reach out and kind of just get it going. But once we started it, he saw the benefit of that and was more on board.
AJ, Will, or Maggie, do you have any last thoughts or advice you would give to someone who's going through a journey similar to yours?
Yeah, I just say be honest, whether it's with your family or with yourself. We talked about conversations we had before, and I'm very grateful my mom was honest with me, and she didn't really try and hide the fact of everything that was going on. I think it really set the stage for later conversations where we could just talk about it and not have to avoid a certain subject. I find that very useful. But also, you have to be honest with yourself. I understand how difficult it is, but I think if you keep sheltering yourself and don't let yourself be vulnerable, it's much harder to grieve. And I found that I grieved the most intense and I think the most meaningful is when I was really just honest with myself.
I know my mom obviously talks about like the importance of connecting with other people. My brother mentioned being honest with yourself, and I think that's really important, connecting with your feeling and understanding like how you feel because of your grief, because the only way you can deal with something is to know it's there and what it is.
Yeah. I agree with my mom that like finding like a similar community who people are going through similar things is very important. It's nice to open up to your close friend and people who are close to you, but I think a really important thing to not to feel pity, to have people not relate to you. So I really agree with my mom that finding a strong community of people who actually are relating to the same thing is really important.
You've all mentioned in some way as advice you would give connection and community. So if listeners wanted to connect with any of you, what would be the best way to do that? We'll put it in the show notes too.
Yeah. If you have Instagram, feel free to reach out to me. My username is AJBrenneman8. So please reach out.
Yeah, my Instagram is just Will Brenneman.
Yeah, my Instagram is that.
And I think I'm on Instagram too. I don't know what my handle is, but it's there. I'll give it.
And Mina, I know you're on LinkedIn too.
Yes.
And you have my LinkedIn, absolutely.
AJ, can people still access your blog even though, you know, you worked on it previously, but why don't we give a shout out to your blog as well so people can go and read it?
Yeah. It's www.200-miles-closer-to-dad.com. And also the GoFundMe is still open. So if you donate, please feel free. All the blogs are still up. I really recommend, if you don't want to read through all of them, just look at the last one. I feel like it encapsulates the entire journey pretty good.
It is a great blog. I recommend it.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much for joining us. It has been an absolute honor to speak with you and continue that relationship you've built with David. This is all a part of it, and it is an honor to be a small piece of that. So thank you for sharing everything with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, pleasure. Thank you. Yeah, this has been a very important and meaningful conversation for all of us too. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to have this conversation.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.